Today happens to fall on the feast of a great saint, and specifically of Anthony the Great. And tonight I would like to borrow from the grace and the wisdom of this holy man, and pass on to you as well certain truths that escape even very advanced Christians. The matter of Anthony the Great is truly great, as he himself is great. And it is supremely a great matter, because it is a matter of grace, and not a matter of knowledge. The matter of Anthony the Great begins from the Holy Spirit and not from human wisdom. That is why his teaching is so valuable, and it ought to be known among Christians. It is true that most of us know something about Anthony the Great. We know about his life. Some of us have read much and others have read little. Yet most of us are deprived of his teaching, because these books that set out the spiritual teaching of Anthony the Great are not found, for the most part, in the libraries of Christians. You see, he belongs to the company of the Neptic Fathers, the Fathers of Watchfulness, as they are called, and all these Neptic Fathers, the noteworthy ones, are set out in the books of the Philokalia, and the Philokalia is, for the most part, unfamiliar to Christians. The first volume of the Philokalia takes up the teaching of Anthony the Great. People today would not want Anthony the Great to speak, because he had no connection with the university, no connection with learning, and yet he has something to say, and they place him first of all, and he speaks about strange things, things that we in this world have wrongly labeled. So, for our honor and for our blessing, allow me tonight to borrow some of these wise words of his, in order to answer certain labels that we are so quick to give to ourselves and to others. If we open this book that we call the Philokalia, we will find him, the first of them, speaking about who ought to be called rational human beings. But someone may ask, are human beings irrational then? And indeed, the saint's view is very different from the way we so readily describe ourselves as rational, or say of someone else, he is a rational human being. Anthony the Great says that man is called rational only in a loose and improper sense. This is why I told you we would misunderstand Anthony the Great today. People are called rational only loosely and improperly. Those who have mastered the writings and the books of the sages of old are not in fact rational because they have read, because they have filled their heads with knowledge, because they have carried whole libraries inside their heads. They are not, he says, rational people. Rather, the rational are those who have a rational soul, able to discern what is good and what is evil, fleeing what is wicked and harmful to the soul, and earnestly studying and holding fast to what is good and beneficial to the soul. These are the ones. These are the ones who ought to be called rational, that a person knows letters, that he has learned, that he has arrived, that, and that, none of this amounts to anything, so long as he does not discern how to flee evil and to cling to the good. And we have many people who are called rational, yet who are not rational at all, according to Anthony the Great, because they do not flee evil. He immediately offers a second reflection on the same subject, expressed in slightly different words. He says that the truly rational person has one concern, and is always interested in one thing throughout life, to obey and to please the God of all. One mark of a rational person is to devote himself day and night, at all times, to discovering how he may be pleasing to God. For this alone he trains his soul, day and night. The rational person takes care to conform his soul to a way of life that is pleasing to God, so that he may please him, giving thanks for the providence and governance over all of him, even when it is bitter. The bitter medicines that the physicians give us, we take them and even thank them for them. And will you refuse the bitter things of God? No, so long as they are saving, you will accept them. These are, as you see, strange words, because they are words of grace. They are words of the Holy Spirit. They are not human words. They are not words of wisdom. They are not from down here on earth. They are brought from above. And these things always sound paradoxical within a person. He then goes on to present the marks of the rational person. The rational person examining himself, tests what is fitting and beneficial for him. What is fitting and beneficial? What he ought to do, not what he wants. Because we, for the most part, do what the flesh wants, what our worldly self wants, what our own advantage wants, even when it is not right, what one ought to do, not what one wants. So the rational person, examining himself, tests what is fitting and beneficial for him. He discerns what is truly beneficial for the soul and what is foreign to it, which things are not right and which are right. He separates these, and so he flees the things that harm the soul, the foreign things that cut him off from immortality, and he holds fast to those things that are beneficial to him and that do not separate him from immortality. In other words, the person who will not take care or will not be willing to avoid the things that harm the soul automatically cuts himself off from immortality. And what is immortality? You know, it is for a person to be together with God beyond the grave. That is immortality, to be together with God. For the person who believes and acts rightly, even though he die, yet shall he live, and does not come into judgment, but has passed from death into life, as a passage of the Gospel says, which, as you know, is also part of the funeral service in the Gospel reading. This holy man also offers another reflection on the same subject, and I will share it with you. Listen to what he says. The rational person, mindful of his participation in and communion with God, will never set his heart on anything earthly or base. He does not cling to or love earthly and lowly things. He avoids them. Instead, he sets his noose, the spiritual mind, and his understanding on heavenly and eternal things, knowing that this is the will of God, that man should be saved. God's will is not simply that man should live a long life or achieve worldly success, but that he should be saved. Where and how he will travel, what he will have to pass through, and all the rest, that is another matter, and it should not preoccupy us. Our concern should be this: I do not know where you will lead me. You may even lead me through the shadow of death. What matters to me, O Christ, is that I be saved and be with you in eternity. That is my concern. And he says here, there is one thing that concerns my God, the salvation of mankind. For he is the cause of all good things and the source of the eternal blessings of mankind. This is the distinguishing mark of the rational person he provides for himself, day and night, both for his own sake and for those who depend on him and are influenced by him. Whoever is not concerned each day for the salvation of his soul is not a rational person. Let him be called rational. Let him have filled his head with vast worldly knowledge. If he cannot discern the chief concern, the salvation of his soul, then according to Saint Anthony the Great, he is not a rational human being. And there is another saying of his that I also call upon. He says, the truly rational soul, seeing the success of the wicked and the prosperity of the unworthy, will not be troubled. Many people are scandalized because certain people, wicked people, strangers to self-sacrifice, prosper, rise in the world, and acquire possessions. The rational person is not scandalized because he keeps certain things in mind, he says, for he knows clearly, that is, the rational person knows full well how unstable fortune is. Things may be one way today, but tomorrow they may be overturned. He also knows the uncertainty of this present life, the brevity of life, and that divine judgment cannot be bribed. So the rational person has weighed these things carefully. He does not call blessed any of those who in some way prosper today apart from God, nor is he scandalized by it. But when people have not understood the matter, they are swept away and go so far as to accuse even God himself. They are scandalized and say to you, "Where is God? Where is justice? I see things in this world that make no sense. I live with complete honesty, yet I cannot even get enough bread to eat, while the other man is a crook, and who knows how he made his fortune, and you expect me to accept that." He has not yet settled down. He is not yet rational. he does not have the grace of the Holy Spirit. He has not sorted out the issues so as to be able to put things in order and not be scandalized. You see what sayings the saints of God have, those who possess the grace of the Holy Spirit, how we see things and how they see things. So you cannot call just anyone rational. You cannot call just anyone rational as long as he does not have the characteristics that the rational person must have. Let me go on. Who should be called a human being? Up to now we have been speaking of who should be called rational. Now I go on and borrow his saying on who should be called a human being. But surely this calls for philosophy. Someone will say, this question of who should be called a human being, the one who differs from the animals, who differs from the birds, from the reptiles, the human being who is set above all of these. One who is not truly human cannot be called a human being, for there are people who outwardly appear human but inwardly are beasts. Such a person cannot be called human. Listen, then, to the exact words of this saintly man on who should be called a human being. A person is rightly called human, either when he is rational, as we said earlier, or when he is willing to accept correction. For the incorrigible person is called inhuman, because refusing correction is the mark of one who is inhuman, and this habit must be shunned. The one who can rightly be called human, and who deserves that name, is the rational person, the one we spoke of earlier, who discerns things rightly, or else it is the person who was careless and failed to do what he should have done as a rational human being, but who, when corrected, accepts it and says, yes, that is how it is. I made a mistake, forgive me. I was wrong. This is what I must do. I repent. I set right the injustice, and I accept correction. The person who refuses correction cannot be called human. He is inhuman. He is a beast. And unfortunately, we have many such people who are called human beings but are not human beings. An altruist, you say, is this man agreed? But what does he do for his soul? He gives his coat, his bread. What does he do for his soul? These things he gives have no bearing on salvation. These things he gives, what is their connection to Christ, to your Christ? Works do not save you. He has no connection to Christ, no connection to the church, no connection to the mysteries. No connection to repentance, to confession, to communion. What good is he to me, even if he gives away his very dentures? It plays no role whatever. So a human being, he says, should be called either the rational one, the one we spoke of earlier, or the one who accepts correction. Yes, I made a mistake. I erred. I did it. I ask forgiveness, and within the limits of my powers I will make it right. Such a one can be called a human being. But the other who remains uncorrected and persists in his own opinion, far from the right opinion, from the opinion that saves, this one should be called inhuman, because he says, this is inhuman, frightful. So it is not simply a matter of bearing the outward appearance, so that we may say, a human being, just as, for example, the world very easily calls God Father. And not only do Christians call God Father, but even non-Christians accept God as Father. And we hear it many times. Yet this is not so. The person who has not received Christ does not have God as Father. To as many as received him, he gave authority to become children of God. He who has not received Christ remains a creature, a created thing, not a child of God. He cannot have God as Father as long as he does not have Christ as brother. Such, more or less, is the thought of this holy man on the question of who should be called a human being. And he continues, he has an equally beautiful saying afterward. And he says, when reason is truly present within us, it makes us worthy to be called human beings. If, he says, reason is with us, and we are guided by it and act rightly, then it makes us worthy to be called human beings, because we possess it. But when reason is absent, we differ from irrational creatures only in the form of our limbs and in our voice. If reason is not there to guide you rightly toward your salvation, then, he says, we differ from irrational creatures and wild beasts only in our speech. Otherwise, we too are irrational. We are not guided by reason. Therefore, let the discerning person recognize that he is immortal, and he will hate every shameful desire. Truly, he says, a sensible person must avoid everything shameful that brings about death, and must take care to do what is right, so that he may remain immortal and not die. I do not mean physical death. We all undergo physical death. Even God, who became man, died. And his mother, the most holy Theotokos, also underwent physical death. I mean spiritual death, for there are two kinds of death. There is the death of the body, when the soul is separated from it, and there is the death of the soul when it is separated from God. When a person separates himself from God, he willingly dies and remains dead. Therefore, someone who does not possess these qualities cannot truly be called a human being. Many of us who are called human beings, and who, above, want to be called human beings, possess none of the qualities that, in the judgment of Macarius the Great, prove us to be true human beings. But let me continue. There is so much here that it would be impossible to cover it all, even in three lessons. We will take the most important points, the ones that concern us directly, as far as time allows. Now here is one saying, who should be called free? Today there is a struggle over this very freedom. I am free to do whatever I want. Since you are free, you should do whatever you please. You are subject to no one. You have no master and no lord over you. But what does it mean to be free? Are you free to blaspheme God? Are you free to take another man's sister or the father of another woman's children? Are you free to steal and rob? What does it mean to be free? Many people misunderstand freedom and misuse it. It is not easy for a person to say that he is truly free. It is not easy. One must be careful. For thousands of years we have been struggling for this freedom, and yet we remain slaves, not to men, but to Satan and to our passions. A man claims to be free and blasphemes. He claims to be free and steals. Yet he is a slave to theft, a slave to blasphemy, a slave to Satan. This is not freedom. Listen, then, to what this man says on the subject of freedom and about who should be called free. Let not those who are free merely by circumstance be considered truly free. What do you suppose a free nation? The peoples of the West are free, the Americans are free, and so on. Not those who are free merely by circumstance, but those who are free in their way of life and in their character. For those who rule should not truly be called free if they are wicked or morally undisciplined, for they are slaves to the passions and to material things. True freedom and blessedness of soul consist in genuine purity and contempt for the things that pass away. If you succeed in remaining pure in body, free from sin, and in regarding as nothing and not becoming attached to transitory material things, fleshly desires, and selfish interests, then you may be called free. Otherwise, you are enslaved. The Greek may be politically free and yet be a slave to money. The Greek may be free and yet be a slave to the flesh. He may be free and yet enslaved to any number of things. He serves the works of Satan and not the works of God. You cannot, he says, call yourself free while you are enslaved to sin. Indeed, to put it figuratively, it would be preferable for us to be slaves to the Turks than slaves to idols. Under the former slavery, there is still some room to take a stand. Under the latter, there is no possibility of salvation for our soul. It means spiritual death. And in truth, many of us have many masters over our heads, even though we call ourselves free. I do not know whether you remember. I think you will when I mention it, but I once told you a very telling story about the old man Kallikratonas. You know what is said about this man. While the fighting was still going on, the old man found himself on Zakynthos and decided to cross over to the Peloponnese with a few other brave young men, so that he too could help in the struggle. He arranged with a boatman to meet at a cape there, by a certain rock, at a set hour in the evening. They would board the boat, and the boatman would quietly smuggle them across, from Zakynthos to Katakolo at Glorensa. Indeed, they gathered, they got in, and it set off slowly with the oars through the night, because the Turks were keeping watch to cross over. They were sitting back where the captain was at the helm, and he pulls out his pouch to have a smoke, to roll a cigarette, or rather, we should say, to fill his pipe. But surprisingly, the pouch had no tobacco. He rummaged through it. There is no tobacco. He was a heavy smoker, and so he showed it to one of the young men to ask whether there was tobacco or not, and to ask down the line the others with whom he might find tobacco, so that they could send him a little to roll one there secretly, to take a few drags, to get him through until they crossed over to the Peloponnese. Surprisingly, of all the 22 young men who were aboard, and the boatmen, not one smoked. Today, out of 22 young men, 25 smoke, and out of 22 girls, 50 smoke. Today, of the 22 young men, not one had tobacco. So what did he devise? He takes out his pipe and a small knife he had, and he stands there now scraping to make a little ash to set a fire. When this thing struck him, he came to himself and said, he stuck the knife in to light it from that. When he made this gesture, he came to himself and said, look at this man who has put his neck on the line, risking being killed by the Turks with the ambition of freeing his brothers, while at the very moment he himself has not been freed from a little load. He is a slave to a little load. With this thought, he took out the pouch, threw it into the sea, the pipe into the sea, the tinder into the sea, the flint into the sea, and he gave up tobacco, the cigarette, from that very evening. This is what we are, the free ones. Take care, sir. What sort of master are you when a packet of cigarettes has enslaved you? I am not even mentioning the other things. I am not mentioning the fleshly ones. I am not mentioning 1,001 other things to which you and I are slaves. How can you call yourself master or you mistress? On what grounds this holy man is therefore right when he says that a person cannot be called free so long as he remains in sin? He cannot be called free. And he has another beautiful saying, which, if you permit me, I would also like to mention, free is the one who is not enslaved to pleasures. Which of us is not enslaved, whether through touch, the flesh, the hands, the eyes, or the ears, to those 5 pairs of oxen in the parable? Which of us is free and can truly be called free? Free is the one who is not enslaved to pleasures, but who, through wisdom and self-restraint, exercises mastery over the body and, with great thanksgiving, is content with what God gives him. And on this point we are caught out as being sinful, as not being free and unburdened. And he has yet another fine view that I should tell you as well, because at this point many of us blame God, saying that he made us this way, that he made Satan, that he permits sin, and so on. And we are the innocent doves. We are the victims. That is what some people believe. So he says, if you choose, you are a slave to the passions. If you choose, you are free and are not subject to the passions. It is in your hands. Thus, you willingly become a slave to the passions, and willingly you refuse to become their slave. For God created you with free will. He made you master of yourself. If you choose, you become a slave. If you do not choose, you do not become a slave. And whoever conquers the passions of the flesh is crowned with incorruption. But why must these things exist? Why must things be this way? Why must there be sin? And why must there be struggle? And so on and so forth. For if there were no passions, there would be no virtues, nor would there be the crowns that God bestows upon those among mankind who are worthy. We need to struggle in order to receive the crown, to receive the well done, to receive the reward. These things are needed, and many times God permits even the fall, so that a struggle may take place, so that a person may come out stronger and have a greater reward. Give the answer of John Chrysostom, where God and the church were blamed when a Christian was slaughtered inside Constantinople. They went and said to John Chrysostom, where is your God? He says, why did he let him be slaughtered there like a goat? Why did God permit it? Remember, he did not wish to deprive him of the martyr's crown. What harm was done? Instead of dying 10 years later, he died today. But today he departed wearing such a crown, one that will remain upon his head. Of course, these are things we cannot grasp, because we have no desire to struggle in such matters. We have no desire at all, and that is why they seem difficult to us, strange, even paradoxical, as we might say. And yet this is so in the final analysis. But let us move on. Our age, above all, has need of this answer of the saint. You know how much labor, care, and effort are devoted to education today, to learning, to acquiring knowledge, as we might say. People stake everything on education, on the intellect. Whole national budgets are devoted to education, to schooling, as we might call it. And what is the ultimate aim, the deeper intention? To build an advanced society of educated people, of intellectuals. I ask you, despite all the progress in education, have we achieved anything of the kind? Is society today any better than it was 20, 30, 40, or 50 years ago, when people were less educated and only a few had received higher learning? Did we read about, see, and hear of so many murders, so many robberies, and so many strange things then? Has man achieved anything through knowledge alone? He has achieved nothing. The only one who forms good and useful people and good and useful societies is Christ. That is why education without Christ is a utopia. It is a double-edged knife that breeds a jungle. It does not produce a society that is upright, useful, and pleasant. And you see it every day. Soon we will not be able to walk outside past 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Things that are already happening in the West, where today people cannot go out of doors at all. Now this man, Saint Anthony, has a teaching on this very matter. He speaks about education, but he says to beware of education that does not have God within it. Godless education, he says, beware of that. Take care against education without God. And our days have gone very far down this road. There is no profit in learning words and cramming your head full of knowledge. There is no profit in learning words if the soul's way of life, well-pleasing and acceptable to God, is absent. If God is missing from your education, he says, there is no profit. The cause of all evils is delusion. For this is a delusion, to learn letters without God, and deceit and ignorance of God. So if you want to learn letters and to be of benefit and to be benefited, you will take care to learn about God as well. If you learn only letters, you are something of a knife, both against yourself and against others. And today's society has need of this counsel. Many times, in the things we discuss with many people who voice their opinion about their children, about the efforts they make to teach them letters. For you know, for the most part, today, children do not want their lessons. On the one hand, it is a fashion, a matter of slogans. On the other hand, Satan, as Saint Anthony the Great again says, does not let children pick up the books that are beneficial to them. A child may read 100 Mickey Mouse comics a day, but Satan will not let that child learn even one sound word from the other books. Yet there are many parents who have many fine things to say, and they say them, and it is true they have no reason to lie. I never grew tired at all, they say. My children study on their own. I never had to run after them. Never had to say, take up the book, never had to suffer over it. And they always come top of the class, and so on and so on. And of course that is a good thing. It is a comfort to a parent to see that his child does not wear him out, and to see that the child truly delivers and makes some progress in the eyes of the world. But the matter, in the opinion of this holy man, does not stop there. These children, the very ones you describe, who study, who do not wear you out, who bring home the 10s and the 20s, have they formed a relationship with God? On Sunday morning, do these children get up and go to church? That is the question. if the child also has a relationship with God, if the child goes to church, if the child confesses, if the child believes, if the child prays, if the child receives Holy Communion, then applause for his tens and twenties in his studies. But if he does not do these things, then whatever he achieves is failure. A moment will come when you will remember this saying of Saint Anthony, "No knowledge profits anything without God. God is not against letters." Basil the Great left Athens with 7 diplomas, but he went there and threw them away, and first spent 5 years in the monastery. Saint Catherine is a king's daughter with 5 diplomas, and she gathered the 150 wise men of Athens and made short work of them all. He is not against it. Paul the Apostle is a marvel of learning. When he came here, he spoke to us in our own tongue. He presented Christ to us out of our own poets, out of our own philosophers, Christ whom we did not know, and he, from Tarsus, brought him to us. He is not against knowledge. Athanasius the Great, the learned St. Nicholas, St. Epiphanius, St. Ambrose, John Chrysostom, St. Gregory, all of them learned men, and today St. Nectarios of Aegina, a learned man. It is not enough to know letters. You must have God together with those letters. Then you will both benefit others and be benefited yourself. If you stop at letters alone, there is no profit in learning words if the soul's way of life, well-pleasing and acceptable to God, is absent. If a man wants no relationship with God and looks only to worldly knowledge, that man is a failure. Above all, I say, this teaching has to do with us today. You know, our education is godless, it is antichrist, and we do not have even 1 in 100 who is religious and believes and learns his letters in order to glorify God. If you read the Wisdom of Solomon, you will see that God gives wisdom, God holds learning, God gives science, God gives knowledge, God gives knowledge, God gives all things. And a man must take all these things that he knows and lay them first at the feet of Christ. So I don't know what is happening with us, what we can offer in this case. One thing only I know, that we must not stop at knowledge alone. We should be troubled and uneasy if the person we love, alongside everything he learns, does not also learn the things of God. Because knowledge profits nothing. Look at the crimes committed today. They are committed by educated people, by learned people, not only by the uncouth you remember. Some time ago, in Aflatocampos, they found a woman, a teacher, though I do not know exactly what she was, with 37 stab wounds. Her boyfriend, the lawyer, had cast her aside, slaughtered her, and thrown her away like a rabbit is skinned. What good, in particular, our diplomas, what good did they do? Did they manage to drive the beast out of their souls? We had read, some years back, that in Kolonaki a fourth-year medical student threw his girlfriend off the third floor down to the street below. What use were his letters? What use were his degrees, when there is no God within to put things in their right place? And every single day, if you read and look, you will shudder. We will not stop reading, we will not stop learning, but we will add Christ as well, we will add God as well, and then things will change, they will be for the good. And today, I repeat, this is something we must add. Man in his pride does not want to. He does not want to humble himself. He does not want to choose Christ as his Lord. That is where the issue lies, and on that everything stands. He sets many lords over his head. Yet Christ he will not set over his head. Satan permits him to set many over his head. But Christ, he does not permit him to set over his head. I was speaking in Patras at 2 in the morning, and a student interrupted me from the back of the hall. I had spoken about freedom and about slavery, and I had brought forward Paul as an argument. I say, if Paul, this giant, this monster of learning, writes that he is a servant of Jesus Christ, what should I say? What should the rest of us say if Paul declares himself a servant? If he acknowledges Christ as Lord, what should the rest of us do? And he interrupted me. This, he says, is foreign to today's way of thinking. Slavery, he says, is foreign. It is not permitted. And yet, this is precisely the point. To enslave me by force is not permitted, but to enslave myself by my own choice is permitted. There are two masters, my dear friends, and I would like to make this clear to you just as I pressed it upon him. I tell him, sit calmly, and I want to answer what I mean by a servant of Christ, and what the servant of Christ truly is. Compared to the slave of the flesh, compared to the slave of fashion, compared to the slave of self-interest, of the self and of others. What is the difference? Because this is exactly where this holy man stakes everything, to draw man out and bring him near to God. Man's freedom reaches only as far as the point where he enslaves himself somewhere. Man is not free. Let him say all he likes, that he is free. Either he will be enslaved to Christ, or he will be enslaved to the devil and to his passions. There is no third place outside these. He is lying. Tell me, I say to him, are you a fornicator or not? He said nothing in this freedom of yours. Are you perhaps a fornicator? No. Then you are a slave. You belong to the flesh. You have become enslaved to the prince of darkness, and he dictates to you what to do. You may also be a blasphemer, you may be a thief, you may be many other things. For if an ordinary young man, and the brazenness with which he sprang up revealed a great deal, acts like this, then I say to you, I do not know you personally. We are simply discussing the matter. You may be this, you may be that, not only the one thing I mentioned, but another as well, and 10, 20, or 30 more besides, none of which you can deny at this moment. And yet, at the same time you claim that you are free, you are not free at all. You are a slave of the demons, and it is they whom you serve. I, for my part, struggle to be enslaved to Christ and to serve him. So do not take offense when I say that I am a servant of Jesus Christ, for it is you who will not say that you are a slave of the devil. It sets you free. It releases you. And he began to draw back and to grow quiet. I do not want, I tell him, to offend you, nor anything of the sort. But I am discussing one side of this that may well be exactly as I am presenting it. Let me tell you, I say, what it means to be a servant of Jesus Christ. The servants of Christ, I tell him, are free. And those who are servants of Christ willingly become his servants, and they desire Jesus as their Lord. But what, I said to him, do you still not understand this? Then I gave him an example that I have told you before, an example drawn from the slave trade. Listen, those of you who have not heard it. In the days when the slave trade still existed, when people bought and sold slaves and exploited them, it is said that a man who owned a large farm once went to the marketplace to buy slaves for his estate. And indeed, he bought some. He bought, let us say, 10, 20, 30, and he set them off to one side. The first owner came and told them, sit here while I go and do my shopping, and I will come back and we will set off for the farm. And indeed he went, did his shopping, and returned in about an hour. When he came back, he found them, one joking, another laughing, another going on about his own affairs, and so on. But there was one among them. This man was actually chained. He was an imposing man, as we say, a match for Jim Lundos, a real giant. Yet he sat there withdrawn and deep in thought without saying a word. The owner kept an eye on him, then went over and asked, what is wrong? Why are you like this? The man did not answer. Tell me, he said, what is wrong? Why will you not speak? Perhaps you are ill. We can go to a doctor now, while we are still here, because once we are out in the countryside, things will be difficult, or we can bring a doctor there, or even turn back. Still, there was no answer. You must speak here. Tell me what is wrong. And why will you not talk? The man said. What is there for me to say? Tell me, he says, what is wrong, and why won't you speak? He says, what should I say? What should I tell you? What are the others saying? I am in no mood for it. Why are you in no mood? He asks him. I heard, he says, how much you paid for me, and I understand what awaits me where I am going. for indeed the seller had asked a great deal for this man, an astronomical sum, as we say. That is to say, if for one and another and a third he had asked 100,000, 70,000, 20,000, 50,000 each. For this one he asked 1,000,000, the buyer. The new master paid it without haggling at all. Never mind all that, this and the other. Take them. So when I heard, he says, how much you paid for me, I understood what I still have to endure, so that you can earn back what you paid for me and turn a profit besides. Because surely you are not taking me on out of charity. The buyer, the master, answers him and says this, are you distressed? Yes, he says, that is exactly why. What else would you have me feel? Well, says the master, I did not buy you to keep you as a slave. Why did I buy you? I bought you to set you free. You are free, go. When the man heard that his master had made such a gesture, that he had bought him only to let him go free. He falls at his feet, he embraces his feet, he kisses his feet, and he says to him, I will be your slave forever. These, my young man, I told him, are the slaves of Christ, who willingly make themselves slaves of Christ, because they know what Christ means to them. And you have not yet learned this one thing. You have learned everything else, but this you have not learned. And that is why you are scandalized when you hear of being a slave to God, to my Lord. I recognize no Lord, he had said earlier and quickly, but I do recognize a Lord, and I give you this example to help you sadly. People have not grasped things this way, and that is exactly why people drown in a spoonful of water. Let me add one more thing, if time allows, about the many people who could have avoided sin if they had kept in mind the omnipresence of God. Sadly, because we do not believe in the omnipresence of God, we sin as though we were alone. Listen to what this holy man says. When you shut the doors of your dwelling and you are alone, you have closed up, you have looked around, and so on, and there is no one inside, or else the one person you wanted inside is there, so that you can do what you mean to do, and you think no one sees you, no one hears you, no one has noticed you. When then you shut the doors of your dwelling, and you are alone, know well and understand that the angel appointed by God to every human being stands there beside you, inside your room, inside your house, right there where you think you are alone. You are not alone. The angel that God has given you is also there. And he guards you. Every evening, average Christian, those of us who pray say a prayer at compline to the angel, holy angel, who watches over my wretched soul and my afflicted life, do not abandon me, a sinner, nor depart from me, and the rest of it. And yet even so, many times we sin as though we were alone, as though no one sees us. In the old church above the beautiful gate, there were always three things painted, an ear, an eye, and a hand. They belong to God who hears all things, because there is no place where God is not, as he adds here. For thus it says, sleepless and never deceived. He stands forever beside you, seeing all things and unhindered by the darkness. There is someone who sees you and is not kept from watching you. Together with this angel of yours, present in every place, for no place can contain him, since he is greater than all and holding all things in his hand. So besides the angel, he says, there is also God who sees you. That ear belongs to God who hears all things, the eye belongs to God who sees all things, and the hand belongs to the angel who writes all things down. When a person sins, three are writing. The devil writes, the angel writes, and the person himself writes.